This week we have a continuation of last week's show. I'll give the Hagdama, but let me first introduce our guests. We have Professor Michael Behe, who wrote one of the most important books of the last century that was voted on by, you know, scholars. It's called Darwin's Black Box. And he basically goes through on a very scientific level of what we've been to believe is gospel, is Tyrus Moshe, that, you know, Darwin knew what he was talking about. And but he's a macrobiologist. He's one of the most studied professors in the country. We will be speaking to Professor Donald Brownlee, who wrote the rare earth hypothesis about post Big Bang. What are the odds of there having an inhabited planet? Right. So we'll be speaking to him and Professor John Kramer, who worked on some of the mathematics. So people have asked me, why don't you have any rabbanim on these shows? And response is that should you encounter doubt, should you encounter that college kid who has, or you meet the Russian, you want a hockey machine, if you want to blunt his teeth, you don't want to hear what, he's not interested in what a Rav has to say and what a Rosh Hashiva, you don't sell coals in Newcastle, what do the greatest scientists of the era have to say? Last week we had Sir Martin Rees of Ludlow, who was the most decorated scientist in England, one of the two or three. Queen's astrophysicist. This week we have three different. You're on the air. Matzah Shabbos, 11 to 12 midnight, WMCA 570 AM. You catch us on Nachum Siegel. You can find all our programs at headlinestorah.com, where you can download anything from all the past shows. Our hotline, 732-806-8700. You can leave messages. You can email questions to info@headlinesbook.com. Next week, we'll have a little bit of fun, and we'll spend a significant part of the show responding to questions that we've gotten from our listeners. And by the way, if you would like to be on, why don't you leave a message on our hotline? That's 732-806-8700. We will pick, you know, a number of them and go through them and respond. So we have a lot of places where we're on WMCA, we're on Nachum Siegel, we're on our own website, you know, Headlines Torah, we're on YU Torah, we're on Torah Anytime, et cetera, et cetera. We like to know, and the hotline was, where are people listening from? So what have we done? We're going to do a raffle this week. If you either email in, I listen to your show on X, either send it to email info@headlinesbook.com. You can call it into the hotline. There's so many different ways. And you say, hi, my name is so-and-so, and I listen on so-and-so. We will be giving, we will do a drawing, 25, that's 25 people who respond will be get Headlines 2, which is with prejudice, with absolute negiya. I'm a negiya bedavar. I'm Adam Karavitz, Alatsmai. The best halacha seifa that will be published in English this year. It's just about being sold out for the second time. And the comments I got on it are just really, I'll maybe read some of the comments a little bit later. But first 25 people who just call up or email in and say, I listen to you. I listen to this show on X because we want to be able to track it. We'll get a happy mail to them of Headlines 2. Even if you've bought it already, it's a great gift. It's beautiful. It's got a beautiful cover. It's great. It has scummas, the pictures, etc. So before we begin, I do want to give... Before we begin, I would like to give a little bit of Hagdama. I'm going to do a very short version of what we did last week. There are opinions in the Achrayim. One should be not chaykir, malam ayla mimcha, accept your emuna and betachin from your avos haktoishim. If you are among these fortunate people, I say, turn off the radio. This is not for you. If, however, you have to deal with somebody who challenges the integrity of our incredible, rich, brilliant tradition, oldest tradition in the world, if you, you know, yourself may the doubts. Maybe you went to school. Maybe you heard the wrong, you had the wrong science teacher, etc. So you have issues, and we're mechuyev to respond to, you know, we have to, a person has to be dam ala hashiv, that apikairis could either be, or that questioner could be external to ourselves. That questioner could be in ourselves. So I encourage you, it's only for these people at the Shoah, and we are being Simech under Rabbeinu Bchaya, and the Chinuch, even though he cites himself in two different places, who says that, you know, an enlightened hasaga of the godless of the Rabbeinu Shalom, of the greatness of creation, the greatness of our Creator, brings somebody to more inspired Yiras Shamayim. I got a beautiful call from Rosh Hashiva in Brooklyn this week. He didn't give me permission, so be Elim Shmai, but really one of the most brilliant Rosh Hashivas, the biggest Eloi probably in Brooklyn, Rosh Hashiva, or maybe giving a hint away, who said he listened to the program and he came away absolutely inspired. So I don't know if this week was going to be as good. We'll try. So we basically went through four different levels of emunah, besides, obviously, you know, accepting it like Ramban says. We went through four different points. Point one was the kasha of Rabbeinu Bachya ben Pekuda. Where did the beginning come from? Something had to create a beginning. And we spoke to both scientists last week, and they said there is no credible explanation for what precipitated the beginning. Period. Point one. The second point we spoke about was that the Big Bang, which is almost exactly defined by the Ramban around 800 years ago. He says the world started from a tiny speck, and it expanded and expanded. After Rabbi Kavyachal made that infinitesimal speck, he created nothing new. After that, it was the Olam, the Spashit, Ad Sha'amar Le'olam Adai, which is what is called the Big Bang. Big Bang, by the way, does not mean that there was a big noise, like those firecrackers. It means sort of the big explosion, the Spashit and the Spashit. So the Ramban wrote about it. And in 1964, science discovered it. Astonishingly, we see that many times in Halacha, where hundreds or thousands of years ahead of the secular courts in Halacha. I'll give you an example. You know that the right for an Adam to protect himself, simple concepts like that, I actually write about in headlines too, was only in England till today. As late as the 70s, it hasn't been established. The concept of Bikuach Nefesh, and new law, I mean, I write about it in headlines too, I encourage you to do it, the law of necessity, I think that piece is called. So we are ahead of them in so many ways. Ramban wrote the Big Bang. So we had on scientists, and basically they said, for the Big Bang to have been successful, there were 17 different constants that happened to occur. The speed, the density, electromagnetic variations, a constant, the cosmological constant, each one with incredibly tiny odds. I mean, I'm talking about odds, 10 to the 22nd is the random event. 10 to the 22nd is the amount of grain of sand that there are on Earth. In other words, go pick up a grain of sand someplace. That's the chance of the... We said that the cosmological constant, which is 10 to the minus 123rd vis-a-vis gravity, minus 123rd is the equivalent of having a neighbor, and the neighbor saying, yeah, I won the Big Bang lottery, or I won the Powerball lottery, which is 1 to 292 million. You would say, wow, you're the most amazing person. But he says, but I'm a little bit unusual. I didn't win it once. I won it 17 days in a row. That's 10 to the minus 123rd power, the odds of that. And there are component after component after component. They say, and you just look at this guy, and all this luck, if it would have been one off here, one off here, one off there, one in a trillion, 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 we would not exist, the Big Bang. He says, that's by coincidence, and these scientists look you straight in the eye and they say, yeah, we got lucky. And you got to scratch your head and say, it may be very bright, but give me a break. So this week we're going to talk about it from two new points, which you've never heard, I can pretty much guarantee you. And one is the rare earth hypothesis, which was Dr. Brownlee, the one who actually wrote it, won many awards for it. The rare earth hypothesis is that he writes that there are 200 constants that a planet has to have to be habitable, things that we take for granted, and he'll explain some of them. That interview was a much longer interview. I'll be honest, it's quite boring listening to, you know, one scientific, so we shortened it a little bit to make it more palatable. If you want to go online, I actually saw you could Google a site called Fine Tuning for Life on Earth by Dr. Hugh Ross, who's a Canadian astrophysicist, where actually breaks down, I see here, 154 of the 200, all with footnotes where they come from. Things like, you know, water absorption of planet's mantle, heat flow to the planet's mantle, through radiometric decay, things like, and so the idea being is, well, what are the odds of their post-Big Bang of having a planet that would have all these 200 perfect conditions, like, just coincidentally? And so, and then we're going to speak to the scientist, Dr. Kramer, who did the math, who said, I don't know, it's just very hard to figure out, but it's certainly greater than 1 in 10 billion that a planet could have all these. So again, you're looking at somebody who's a non-believer, and he says, we don't know where it came from. There are, you had to win the lottery 17 days in a row. It's one of 17 components of the Big Bang. And if the Big Bang is successful, now you have 200 components to have a habitable planet. And we did mention, by the way, the great mathematician Fermi, Enrico Fermi, one of the thrusts to writing this is when he was told, you know, that there should be just a huge amount of habitable planets. He scratched his head and he said, well, how come there's no evidence of any of them? And there are scientific ways how we could have evidence, radio bursts, etc. So that's another component. That's component number three. But we're going to lead this session with Professor Michael Behe, who's a Lehigh professor of microbiology, and he's going to be talking about Darwin. And wherever we go, Darwin, Darwin, here's somebody who studied it at length and will go through some really remarkable deficiencies in Darwin's theory, quite astounding. Just assuming everything he says is right, but walking through the mathematical odds of some of these things happening, like 200,000 proteins in a person's body happening randomly, when you look at it, they are so astonishing. Now, and you could ask your favorite Kuiper out there, say, Mr. Lichtenstein, and I'm good for the money, you could Google me, said, you really believe all this? Well, here's my bet, I'll go online. Take your favorite Kuiper. We'll put him in a room, right? He said doing a Rubik's Cube blindly for a person, right, would take a number of lifetimes. That's how common. And he said each protein is that complicated. You have a smart guy, he says he could do it. Say, he'll put me in a room with him. I'll bet him his $100 to my $100,000. He has 8 hours blindfolded to do the Rubik's Cube. His 100 to my 100,000. That's what 200,000 of those happen. You have somebody who wants that bet, I'll do that bet all day. That's how confident I am. Let's see when some of these believers, you ask them to put their money where their mouth and say, do you really believe that? So let's go to our first guest. Really an honor to have him. Worth listening to. Dr. Michael Behe. We have the honor of having with us on the phone Professor Michael Behe, who wrote a book that was voted one of the 100 most important books of the 20th century, called Darwin's Black Box. He's a professor of biochemistry at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania. He's a senior fellow of the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. He's one of the most well-known writers in the field of irreducible complexity. Welcome, Professor Behe.
Thanks very much. It's great to be with you.
So, Professor Behe, our audience are lay people, which means for the most part they don't have degrees in biochemistry. Could you explain to lay people, give us an example. First, tell us what your research is, and then give us a few examples that, assuming that they're idiots like I am, that we can, things that we can actually understand.
Okay, sure. Yeah, my book that I wrote about this called Darwin's Black Box was targeted to lay people. You know, there's just the reading public. And, you know, everybody knows that science can have technical details and so on. But the nice thing about this is that the overarching important points are really pretty simple. And it's this, that back in the day when Darwin was working and came up with his idea of evolution, not only evolution, but evolution by random processes plus natural selection. Back then, our knowledge about life was pretty restricted and about nature overall. For example, back in the middle of the 19th century, nobody was sure if molecules existed. They were kind of theoretical entities, but nobody was sure if they actually existed. And the cell, which we now know to kind of be the basis of life, the basic structure of life, was was thought to be very simple. It was thought to be a kind of a glob of jelly called protoplasm. But in the 150 plus years since he worked, science itself has progressed tremendously, and we found that, in fact, the cell is not simple at all. It's horrendously complex and much more sophisticated and intricate than most machines that we use in our everyday life. And the big discovery of science in the past 50 years, or at least in biology, is that the cell is literally run by machines, literally molecular machines. There are little machines that act as outboard motors on bacteria cells to let them swim through liquid. And there are other machines in our cells that walk along highways made out of other molecules, kind of like those robot walkers in Star Wars, and they pull along kind of trailers that are filled with supplies because the cell needs to get supplies from one end of it to the other. And there are little signs, highway signs, essentially, made out of molecules that the scanners on these walking machines have to recognize, and they know which supplies to drop off in which places and so on. So the one basic point is that the life has turned out to be, you know, marvelously more complex than Darwin or folks back in that day took it to be.
Professor, you have a few marvelous examples in your book. Could you share them with us?
Sure, yeah. Let's see. I think the best one for people to first look at is something called the bacterial flagellum. And the bacterial flagellum is quite literally an outboard motor that bacteria can use to swim. And I'm not saying that figuratively, that's literally. It's got a part that acts as a propeller, and it is spun around and around and around by other parts, and the propeller then pushes against the water in which the bacteria is swimming and therefore pushes the bacterium forward. And the propeller is attached to a portion called the drive shaft, which spins, and it is spun by the motor, which is a rotary motor, just like the motor that spins a propeller on a motorboat in our everyday world. And the motor is attached to the bacterial outside, the membrane, just like an outboard motor in our everyday world is clamped onto the boat. If it fell off, of course, it wouldn't do much good. And that acts as a stator or something that keeps it in place. And there are dozens of different mechanical parts that are necessary for this thing to work. And if it's missing one of those parts, then it's in big trouble. So that's one. Another one is the blood clotting system. You know, most people don't think much about it, but, you know, a guy gets up in the morning and, you know, shaves and nicks your neck and a little bit of blood trickles out and slows down and stops and heals over. You know, what's the big deal? But it turns out that research in the past 50 years or so has shown that blood clotting is an enormously complex process. And it's not complex just because it kind of makes a glob that stops blood, but it has to be regulated really, really finely, because if your blood clotted at the wrong place or the wrong time, you might be in big trouble. That's how heart attacks and strokes can happen. So what happens is that there's this substance in the blood, a protein, which just kind of floats around. But when a cut occurs, another component comes over and cuts off a piece of the first one, a little tiny piece that allows it to kind of bind or stick to other copies of itself. And that starts to form kind of a fisherman's net, which is part of the clot. Now, if this substance that forms the clot were initially present in its active form, it would aggregate, form the fisherman's net, and all your blood would be coagulated, and you'd be in bad shape then. So it's this other thing that initiates it. But what starts the other thing? Why doesn't the other thing that clips off this little part, why doesn't it activate whenever possible? Why does it wait? And it turns out there is another part of the system that activates the second part. And then there's another part that activates the third part, another and another and another. So it's kind of this Rube Goldberg-like machine where one part starts another working, another one working. And it might seem complex to us, but that's needed, again, to make sure that blood clots form only when they're supposed to, at the place and at the time when they're needed. Otherwise, there'd be big trouble.
So, Professor, why couldn't this have evolved by itself, as Darwin says, the flagellum or this blood clotting machinery? How did you use this to find fault in Darwin's argument that it just occurred?
Well, Darwin proposed his idea of evolution by random variation and natural selection. And he said that the idea is that you've got some system that works already, and then a little tiny change in it comes along, and that helps. And most changes don't help, but one does, and it is selected by natural selection so that the offspring of the mutant organism would have a better chance of living than organisms that didn't have this change. And then another one came along later after generations, and another, and so they would add up to form some helpful feature in life. But Darwin always insisted that this had to be gradual, just tiny, tiny, tiny steps, improving it slightly, slightly, slightly at a time, because he knew that if things improved quickly and in big leaps, then it would look like it wasn't a random process. It would look like it was intended or something. So he always insisted on this gradual approach. Well, it turns out that a lot of things can't be built gradually, improving them in tiny steps. And one thing is, and I should say that I term these things irreducibly complex because they need a number of different parts in order to work. If you think back to that example of the flagellum, which was the outboard motor that bacteria used to swim, suppose you had a whole outboard motor, but it was missing the propeller, so that the motor worked and the drive shaft spun around, but there was nothing to push against the water. Well, it would be kind of useless. Well, what if you had the propeller, but you didn't have the drive shaft to attach it to the motor? Well, again, you might have most of the components, but you need them all. So the thing is that those systems, the systems that need a number of parts to work, can't be built by these numerous slight modifications that Darwin insisted on. And on the other hand, they are exactly those kinds of arrangements where you have different parts that don't really do anything by themselves, and they're ordered to each other and brought together to make a nice functioning device. That's kind of the hallmarks of purposeful design that we recognize in our everyday life. If you looked at an outboard motor anywhere, if you came across it, you know, it's been tossed out in a field, or you would immediately know that it was it was put together by somebody who knew what he was doing, and you'd know that simply because you saw how the parts fit to each other.
So there would be no need for the drive shaft and the cranks if the propeller wasn't there. If everything was there except for the propeller, you could say evolution could create the propeller. But why create all those steps unless in the beginning somebody knew that the end result would be a propeller?
That's right. So essentially you're asking this blind process to foresee the future, foresee what it's going to make. And it's starting off with something that's really kind of not useful in itself. but only will be useful later. But evolution, as Darwin envisioned it, doesn't have the ability to foretell the future. It takes a mind to do that.
Now, let me ask you a question. I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Paul Davies.
Sure, I am.
Yeah, but he writes...
Well, Dr. Davies writes, he says that the human protein is one of the most complex molecules that there are, marvelously complex. And he says that it has as many components as a Rubik's Cube. So he says a protein molecule occurring on its own, right, is as like a blind person would be turning a Rubik's Cube and getting it correct. So here's something I didn't know. I Googled it. How difficult it is? All the possible permutations of one Rubik's Cube are, it's a 43 with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, with 21 zeros after it. It's 4 billion times 4 billion. Those are the different. So just to give you an example, the amount of seconds in a person's life, if he did nothing but take a Rubik's Cube from the day he was born, turn it, every second, 24 hours a day, until he was 90 and lived till 90 and died. I don't know how such a person could live till 90. Is 2,800,000 seconds. This is 43 billion times 4 billion. It would take 43 billion people, blind people in a room, to get a Rubik's Cube right. Astonishing the amount of different, those are the possibilities. So he says, okay, so they got one protein right randomly. But he says there are 200,000 proteins, 200,000 in the human body. So it's the equivalent of having 200,000 blind people in a room, each getting the Rubik's Cube right. That is what it's like when we say, according to Darwin, that the human evolved through random chance. We put 200,000 people doing the Rubik's Cube. And remember, we said it would take 43 billion. It's rather 4 billion times 2 billion. It would take 4 billion times the 200,000 to get. Isn't this like just, it's just absurd, isn't it? I mean, could a protein, 200,000 proteins have created themselves randomly if anybody has just any type of mathematical sense in their head?
Yeah, well, this isn't controversial. Nobody would say that they could. Even Richard Dawkins, or the most ardent Darwinist, would say that. He's quite correct, Paul Davies, is that that's impossible. And everybody knows it's impossible, so the Darwinists and such folks look for, you know, ways around that. They say, well, yeah, sure, that's impossible, but maybe in the past, you know, a cell could work with fewer proteins, and maybe they had to be shorter, and maybe they had to be less complex, and so on. And so they kind of retreat into imagination. And if you ask them, well, okay, that's a good idea. Can you show me or describe for me what these machines, these proteins would be like that were simpler, and they can't do that. They just kind of wave their hands and say, well, maybe it was simpler. So that's kind of the stumbling block for somebody who wants to convince these people that they're barking up the wrong tree, that in fact they, just like Darwin himself, who speculated about many, many things. He, of course, had no example of the origin of any species back in his day. And he speculated about, oh, maybe a bear could turn into a whale if it swam in the water long enough and kept its mouth open. And that tradition of substituting imagination for actual research results and has unfortunately continued to the present.
So, Professor, I have a question for you, and this is borders on science, a little bit philosophy, a little bit, because you know this industry so well. Given that there is so much that when we look at, we say it's so highly improbable, like Paul Davies just puts a 10 with some huge number of zeros behind it as the likelihood of something like this happening, why does so much And in fact, I would make the following statement. You need as much faith to be an atheist as you need to believe in a designer, in a creator. Why then does science, looking at the, you know, your statistics, Paul Davies says, why do they dig their heels in so vigorously and say, no, it's random? Like, what's the logic behind that?
Well, a lot of times there isn't much logic, of course. I think it has to do with, essentially with a large amount of territorial disputes. And there's also, of course, philosophical reasons, too. But just concentrating on the territorial disputes, if, in fact, life was designed, if there was a mind that made it, and that probably would be beyond science. And then scientists would be rather less important, and maybe clergymen and folks like that would be more important and more highly regarded, as they were in Darwin's day when he first put out his theory, and a number of scientists flocked to Darwin's theory specifically because they didn't like the Anglican clergy of their day, especially a guy named Thomas Huxley, who was Darwin's bulldog. He saw this more as a way to essentially get the church out of biology than to answer really questions, to truly answer questions. As a matter of fact, a number of scientists were very attracted to the idea of evolution, but they thought Darwin's explanation, random changes in selection, was dumb or just couldn't get the job done, just like Paul Davies thinks and most of us think. But they thought, hey, maybe we'll come up with something else. And so we're going to claim the right to explain where life came from. And we'll say that your contention that, in fact, it required design is just religion, and that's, we will say, that's illegitimate. So unfortunately, it I think a large part of it is this kind of turf, defending their turf. And, of course, another large part of it is that a lot of people, including many scientists, simply don't want reality to be like that. They don't want to have a God or a mind or something beyond our control.
What they control. So,
yeah.
Professor, you're a biochemist. Could you see, do you see it as possible that DNA is comprised of 3 billion letter code? Francis Collins said that if it was written in books, it would be the height of the Empire State Building. That would be one DNA, basically of one human, the code of one human, right? In books, the letters are, and if you invert 2 letters at a certain part, it creates the most hideous diseases.
Right.
Do you think a book of 3 billion letters, as high as the Empire State Building, that thick, that's a lot of phone books on top of each other, is there any logical way for somebody to say, it's a random occurrence that they have to line up in an exact way, and over X number of billion or trillion of years this happened? As a biochemist, is there any possibility to say that?
No, there is no experimental or theoretical basis to do so. But essentially, people just cross their fingers and say, well, we want this to happen, and this is the only way we can explain it through natural events anyway, so we're going to stick to our story here. You try to talk people out of it, and they'll just say, well, no, we like science, as if science required you to be illogical on the origin of life. And it really tragically is that because people say this is our story, they teach it to kids, to students. And they say, well, this is the scientific explanation for how life came about and how it changes over time. And they really tread very, very lightly on problems, and students come away with an impression that science has explained it all for you, and then they say, well, we don't, you know, need to we don't need to invoke any higher power, we don't need to follow any rules. There are no rules except the ones we make up for ourselves. So that's the difficulty.
Well, Professor Behe, thank you very much. It's been an honor to have you with us. This is Professor Michael Behe, who authored Darwin's Black Box, which was voted as one of the 100 most important nonfiction books of the last century. Thank you, Professor Behe.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, now we're going to go to the next point of the next part of our show. We'll be speaking about the rare earth theory with Dr. Michael Brownlee, who really is the author of this hypothesis. Let's go to our guest.
We have the distinct honor of having with us on the phone Professor Dr. Donald Brownlee, who's a professor of astronomy at the University of Washington. He's NASA's NASA's principal investigator of the Stardust mission. He's a graduate of University of California at Berkeley. He's also the distinguished visiting professor in the University of Chicago of the Enrico Fermi Institute. Professor Brownlee has been awarded the J. Lawrence Smith Medal from the National Academy of Sciences. He's the NASA Medal, the NASA Medal from the Exceptional Scientific Achievement. He has many other titles and awards. It's a big honor to have you on with us, Professor Brownlee.
Thank you very much.
So, Professor, you wrote a book called Rare Earth, Why
Yep.
Complex Life is Uncommon in the Universe. Dr. Brownlee, can you tell us how rare is it? How hard is it to create a planet that has life on it? Can you give us an example to our audience, which is a lay audience, of just try to describe the thesis of the book? Can you talk to us and explain what a galactic survival belt is?
The galactic survival belt. Well, that's the idea that there may be, in our galaxy, in our Milky Way galaxy, there are regions where you wouldn't expect to find Earth-like planets that would harbor life. For instance, there are some areas in the galaxy, like in the center, where there's a higher abundance of massive stars that explode as supernovas, and that is a detriment to organisms because of the radiation that they produce. It doesn't mean that life is not possible there. It just means that life is going to be harassed by things, external environments. And also there are other areas of our galaxy where the elements that make Earth-like planets. I mean, our planet is mostly made out of iron, magnesium, silicon, and oxygen. And yet you go to some regions of our galaxy, the abundance of those elements is actually less. So if you try to make an Earth-like planet, you would have fewer building materials. And so instead of making something the size of the Earth, maybe it would be something smaller, like the size of Mars, which is about half the size of the Earth, or even smaller, like an asteroid. So there are even whole galaxies that are really bad for making Earth-like planets because the chemical elements needed to make Earth-like planets and life are underabundant.
So what percentage of stars in the Milky Way galaxy could support large life, like intelligent life, a non-microid level? What percentage would you say?
Well, we don't know. We don't know. Only a minor fraction of stars are actually like the sun. You always hear the comment that, well, the sun is an average star. Well, that's not true. Most stars are called M stars. They're lower mass stars, and they're redder and cooler. And these cooler, redder stars have lots of planets. We've found an enormous number of planets, exoplanets, orbiting them by like the NASA Kepler mission that loses transits when you see the dip when a planet goes in front of the star. So these stars have lots of planets, but they're quite different than our star because they're much cooler, and the planets that have to be warm enough to have liquid water on the surface have to be really, really close to the star. In fact, so close that they're tightly locked. Tightly locked means that one side of the planet always faces the star, like the moon. You know, our moon is tightly locked on Earth. We only see one side of the moon because it's always facing us. Well, these really low mass stars, they're their planets that can have liquid water are so close that they're tightly locked. So there's one side of the planet is always in the daytime, and the other side of the planet is always in the dark side, which is very un-Earth-like. And it would be, who knows what the effects of that are on life. Maybe life can survive. Maybe it can't. We just don't know.
What about ultraviolet balance, Dr. Brownlee? You write about ultraviolet balance. Could you explain that?
Yeah, well, ultraviolet is if you're around a hot star and you don't have oxygen in the atmosphere, we are protected from ultraviolet light from the sun because it's absorbed by oxygen high in the atmosphere. Oxygen breaks up and forms ozone. There's an ozone, famous ozone layer that absorbs a lot of the ultraviolet. So if you have an atmosphere without oxygen in it, the UV comes right down to the surface. Mars, the UV, ultraviolet light from the sun, goes right down to the surface. And it produces a very nasty, nasty chemical condition. So if you were an organism on Mars and you ever got close to the surface, you would be exposed to this sort of deadly ultraviolet radiation. And other chemical effects also that tend to actually destroy organic compounds. So, you know, from our standpoint, we kind of commonly imagine that life is based on molecular structures similar to what we see on Earth. So you have to have an environment that's compatible with the survival of those materials, which means protection from severe chemical environments and also ultraviolet radiation or X-rays or whatever that could break those bonds.
So can you talk about another constant you call star stability?
Yeah. The sun is, we've been fortunate on Earth that the sun has been, reasonably constant for a long period of time. It doesn't fluctuate. There are stars that are variable stars that get brighter and fainter.
Okay. So you were saying that star stability means, stars are instable. They become more luminous, less luminous. And imagine if we were the Earth and the sun changed its heat by 10 or 20%, we would either freeze or fry. And that's called star stability, which a lot of stars don't have. Planets were much larger. For example, take Jupiter, which is like 300 times the size of Earth. That means I weigh around 170 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Each of us would weigh between, 50,000
mm-hmm.
pounds plus or minus. I mean, if you were obese, you would weigh 100,000 pounds. Could life survive? I mean, could intelligent life survive where the being weighed 50,000 pounds?
Well, if we knew how life really evolved, we could have a better estimate of that. So if you just turned up the gravity on Earth, what would the effects be? For one thing, if the surface gravity was too high, there wouldn't be any birds, because it wouldn't be possible for them to have enough lift-to-drag ratio to actually fly. And you probably would have fewer large animals because they couldn't support themselves under the big weight. But, we think that earthly-like planets, solid rock kind of planets, go up to about 50% larger than Earth. And once you get something beyond that, then you get something with a really extended atmosphere, probably rich in hydrogen. And it's a completely different situation than we have on Earth, where we have this nice rocky surface and a fairly thin atmosphere.
What about planetary obliquity?
Again, we can compare Earth and Mars. So Earth is, tilted about 22.5 degrees. Right now, relative to its spin axis, relative to its orbit. And this tilt of the spin axis determines the ratio of heat that goes like to the pole versus the equator throughout the year. And if the spin axis was tilted high enough, you actually put more heat into the polar regions during the year than you do in the equator. So you have this imaginary thing of living on a planet like that, where people would be going to the pole for their summer vacation, something quite different than we have here. But anyway, a large tilt axis is probably going to lead to more unstable living conditions for animals. and things that are likely to go extinct because of environmental changes. And amazingly enough, if we compare ourselves to Mars, there's calculations that show that the obliquity, the tilt axis, the spin of Mars has flopped all over the place from, you know, perpendicular to its orbit to almost 90 degrees. And the difference between Earth and Mars is that Earth has this huge moon. Our moon is like a sister planet to us, and its gravitational effects tend to stabilize our spin axis, so it's been constant for a very long period of time, whereas Mars doesn't have a big moon. Mars's moons are only like 10 kilometers in size.
So basically, you need a planet to support life would most likely to have planetary stability, and not obliquity would have to have a large moon to stabilize.
All these factors are just factors. You know, we don't know how important they are, but they're factors, because you can think about what would happen on Earth if something changed, like if the Earth tilted over 90 degrees. You know, the Earth would be, you know, all the things that live in the tropics would all of a sudden have a totally different environmental conditions. The things that in the Arctic would be exposed to intense sun, so it would be actually a catastrophic change on life on Earth. Maybe it would adapt to it, but this is a factor. It doesn't necessarily prevent life.
These are all factors.
It makes it much
right.
different than it is here.
Can you speak about another factor, orbital eccentricity, elliptical orbits versus non-elliptical orbits?
Yeah, so this is very interesting. You know, most of the planets in the solar system have quite circular orbits, and one of the astounding things about exoplanets around other stars is the majority of them have, actually many of them have fairly elliptical orbits. They're very, very different than we see here. So if you're on a planet with an elliptical orbit,
Please describe an elliptical orbit for the audience, Dr.
Okay. So the Earth has a very fairly circular path around the sun. So we get, you know, we have seasons because of the tilt, but the brightness of the sun doesn't change very much because we're kind of a constant distance from the sun. If we had an elliptical orbit, we would be much closer to the sun during part of the year than 6 months later at the other part. I mean, classic examples of highly elliptical orbits are comets, which come in from the outer solar system and zip around the sun and go back out. So they're highly elongated elliptical orbits where the distance between the planet and the star varies, can vary a lot over time. For the case of a comet, it can vary by a factor of 100 or so. But anyway, if you have a planet and you're thinking of its biological potential, it's a complicating factor if its distance between the planet and the star is changing over time, because you want stable conditions, you want oceans that don't freeze over, don't boil away, you want constant light, so, you know, trees that grow in some area don't become extinct because all of a sudden there isn't enough light for them. You know, you like some ecology to set up. And so if a planet is in an elliptical orbit, it's a harassment of environmental conditions that would...
The summers, in effect, when we were closer to the sun, would be intensely hot. And the far side of the orbit, whereas, you know, if it wasn't round but it was sort of elongated, our winters could become, you know, Siberian winters or less than that. How cold is it on Pluto? It goes to like hundreds of degrees below zero. So the long side of the orbit could destroy all life in the winter. Is that correct?
Yeah, right. So you can imagine where an Earth had a highly elliptical orbit and the oceans would like freeze, you know, when it's far from the star, and then melt when it's close to the star. And you imagine, say we had an orbit that took like 10 years to go around. So imagine a couple years of really hot conditions and almost a decade of really cold conditions. You know, it would be, you know, maybe life would adapt to that, and maybe it wouldn't.
And I think that also goes into another thing, orbital length. For example, Neptune takes 165 years to make one orbit.
Right.
If Earth had that orbit, so winter would last basically 41 years or so, and the whole world, the entire planet would starve out. There would be nobody left after 41 years of winter. And what would you say, Doctor, about the gravity?
Okay, we're going to interrupt Dr. Brownlee here and go to our next guest, who is the mathematician who actually worked through the formula of what are the odds of hitting all 200 constants to have a habitable planet. Listen to this.
We have the honor of having with us on the phone from Seattle, Professor Dr. John Kramer. He's a physicist. He's a nuclear physicist, quantum physicist, ultra-relativistic, heavy ion physics, HBT, infirmatory, novelist, popular, and he's also the author of a number of books. A big honor to have you with us. Welcome,
okay.
Professor Kramer.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Professor Kramer, you wrote an article called The Rare Earth Hypothesis, in which you try to flesh out the rare earth hypothesis in a little bit of a mathematical level and to put some type of numerical functions sort of juxtaposed with the theory. Can you walk us through a little bit of the math? What would it take mathematically to have an inhabited planet?
Okay, the thing is that in order to, I guess you can say you need multiple visits from the tooth fairy. There are various things that have to be in place before you can have an inhabited planet, and each of them has a certain probability. And the way the mathematics works is you have to multiply those probabilities together to get an estimate of, at the bottom line, of exactly how many, out of a million planets, how many could have actually intelligent life on them. I presume you're talking about intelligent life and not just life.
That's correct. We're talking about not micro, but actually large intelligent life.
Yes.
So I see you created a formula. Could you walk us through?
Well,
you know,
I didn't really create the formula. It was created by Frank Drake. I just put somewhat different numbers in it than Frank did. Frank Drake is one of the pioneers of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And many years ago, he formulated something called the Drake equation, which is this sort of ensemble of probabilities. And after I read the rare earth hypothesis by Brownlee and company, I wrote an analog column about it, and I tried to put in some numbers into that column, saying, you know, what the deal is, what you can actually expect if you put in more realistic numbers. And some of them are fairly strange. Our solar system probably formed in a rather unusual way, in that there's something called the Nice model, which indicates that sometime during early planet formation, the planets Jupiter and Saturn went into what's called an orbital resonance. And this has the effect of sending out repeated gravitational shocks that jar everything around them out of their orbits. And so there was a shakeup, as you might say, in the solar system. And the planets Uranus and Neptune were sufficiently preserved that they switched places. And a whole lot of stuff, icy stuff from outside the solar system, or from the outer parts of the solar system, came and bombarded the inner solar system. See, it's rather peculiar that the Earth, which is a rocky, hard, rocky planet that formed inside the zone where water is would vaporize in space, has so much water. And the question is, where did all that water come from? And the Nice model, it seems to indicate that the water probably came from this bombardment at the outer from the outer solar system. That a whole lot of ice, after the Earth had formed, a whole lot of icy stuff fell in and created our oceans. Now, that's not very likely in a given solar system. The fact that there was this resonance between two giant planets that shook things up this way. So that makes that's one of the things that makes the probability of other Earth-like planets having large oceans like the Earth does somewhat unlikely. Another interesting aspect of why of our Earth and is the stability of our seasons. If the seasons were not as stable as they are, it would be much more difficult for life to form. And the reason our seasons are as stable as they are is because the Earth's axis tilt, which makes the seasons, is sort of locked in place by having a big moon in orbit around us that acts as a sort of a gyro stabilizer that keeps the Earth's axis pointing in the same direction. And so that's another factor that is important. And the Earth to Moon ratio is the biggest in the solar system. No, there are other planets that have big moons, but nothing that has as big a moon for the size of the planet. And so, again, if you're looking at alien planets, what's the likelihood that they would have a similar moon situation which would stabilize their seasons? So there are this whole series of factors which make evolution of intelligent life not so likely on other planets. If you look at the recent results that are coming out of the Kepler mission of NASA, where they're actually doing planet searches and looking for extrasolar planets, they tend to find that when they have an Earth-like planet, it's usually around a relatively small star. And the trouble with that sort of situation is that the extrasolar planet close to a small, dim star has to be very close to the star in order to get enough sunlight to support life. And the problem with that is that when you're so close to a small planet, you get a tide lock situation, similar to the way the moon is tide locked to the Earth and always shows the same face to the Earth as it rotates around. And so the net result of that is that most of these planet candidates that Kepler has been finding are in tide lock situations where one side of the planet will always be pointing towards the star and be a hot side, and the other side of the planet will always be away from the star and be a cold side. And perhaps the oceans and the atmosphere will tend to freeze out on the cold side, and there will only be a ring around the edge, of sort of a twilight zone around the edge of the planet, where life could actually exist in a more Earth-like situation.
So yes. If you had to put a mathematical, you would say the odds of the intelligent life on Earth are X. It's 10 to the what, to the 2, to the 3. What would, try to give us some type of a feel.
Okay, I don't remember the numbers that precisely that I came up with before, but it's something like 1 in 10 billion or something like that.
Thank you for listening. That was a great show. Again, the first show we spoke about, where did the bang come from? Science has no thing. Where did we come from? They don't know. The Big Bang, something precipitated it. We then spoke about the constants for the fine-tuning of the Big Bang. Again, incredible, astronomically bizarre odds. Then we spoke about this show, how Darwin, the human body, just so many different parts of it, the proteins, the phlegm, happen by themselves, astronomically remote, nothing you would ever take a bet on. Again, I'll repeat that bet. Put somebody here with the Rubik's Cube. Let's do the bet. And the last thing we spoke about is the rare earth theory. So I think we have four very powerful things. In closing, I want to remind everybody, if you enjoy this program and you find it inspiring, go out and buy Headlines 2. It is the best halacha sefer you will buy this year. And your kids will read it. You will read it. Your guests will read it. There will be a fight by the table over who gets it first. This is David Lichtenstein wishing you a good tzavach.